As usual.
There you go.
There we go. So we'll start off with introductions, and as usual, I'll read the state, and if you're from that state, just say hello and who you are. Is anyone on the line from Minnesota? From Missouri?
This is Scott Park.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, this is Scott Perkins from Missouri. I was asked to kind of join by some of the other normal participants of the communities of practice.
Yes, great. Thank you. From Nebraska? From North Carolina?
Jane Miller.
Hi.
Hi.
Anyone else from North Carolina? All right, from North Dakota? Oklahoma? From Puerto Rico?
From West Virginia?
Oh, who's that?
Shelley Stoniker from West Virginia.
Oh, hi, we're almost at West Virginia, but thank you for...
Uh-huh.
Great. Okay. From Tennessee? From Virginia?
Hi, this is Christina Benton with the Virginia Department of Health, and I believe one of my colleagues might be on as well.
Maybe?
Yes, this is Kathy Harkey from the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Virginia.
Welcome. And from West Virginia?
And Shelley Stoniker from the West Virginia Department of Education.
Welcome. Any other folks from states who we haven't heard from yet? All right, from our partners, do we have anyone else on the line, any partners? Is there anyone from Children's Safety Network?
Yes, there is. Hi, Erica. This is Jennifer Allison from Children's Safety Network.
Welcome. And from Suicide Prevention Resource Center? Is that Julie Eben on the line? Maybe she's having technical difficulties. Anyway, I see Julie from SPRC, so welcome. Anyone else on the line? Oh, there she is. She's joining us, saying hello from her chat. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. All right. Anyone else who hasn't been able to introduce themselves, speak now or type now.
Yeah, this is Julian Cabore from the Health Department in Oklahoma.
Oh, welcome. Hi, Julian.
Hi.
All right. Well, thank you. And we've got a great session today. So, Bailey, if you could mute the phone lines now, we can move along.
Okay. Will do.
Great. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. Barry Fawcett is the Project Director of Adolescent Suicide Prevention and Early Intervention, or the ASPEN program. She oversees and implements directives from West Virginia's Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Grant in providing statewide suicide prevention trainings, enhanced recognition and referral systems, and capacity-building initiatives for suicide prevention efforts. And a little bit differently today, we're actually going to do Barry's questions right after her presentation. So if you have questions for her, you can start typing those into the chat box, and Barry will take those questions after her presentation. Go ahead, Barry.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to present this information today and sharing experiences of our Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Grant directives as they apply to suicide prevention efforts in rural communities. We have been awarded in 2006 and then again in 2009 in our state to provide for suicide prevention for adolescents. We've learned a lot of lessons and built upon initial grant directives in order to provide for a comprehensive framework, again, for interacting with at-risk individuals. Our project is called Aspen. However, I came into the project after its inception, and that seems kind of confusing in regards to suicide prevention. So we prefer to promote the Hope Help Life Association, as suicide prevention is conceptualized in letting individuals know there is hope, seek help, and ultimately choose life. I really recognize the privilege to work on efforts to cease this silent epidemic in our state. Today, we're just going to, advance slide, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm kind of in a remote location today. Okay. Today, again, I'm not proclaiming to be an expert in prevention in rural America, but I do want to share the experiences and lessons learned as we've consulted recommendations of the supplied document done by the SPRC Rural Youth Suicide Prevention Work Group, as they've applied to our initiatives and efforts in West Virginia in promoting a multifaceted public health approach to suicide prevention. So hopefully today we can talk about the culture and ideology of suicide in rural communities, the obstacles and barriers unique to suicide prevention and intervention in rural America, as well as how we have tailored our interventions to rural populations and some of the successes of those endeavors. It's working. Okay, so what conceptualizes a rural community? Well, according to the literature, there's a low population density. You know, residents, there's in relatively small communities and often separated geographically. Specific to West Virginia, we're generally regarded as the second most rural state in the country. 64% of our population resides in communities of 2,500 people or fewer. And then there's the rural Appalachian culture that the beliefs, norms, and values throughout West Virginia are typical of rural Appalachia. There's strong ties to the land. There's multi-generations living in close proximity, a very strong church affiliation, and male head of household, and then our famous, have a hard time asking help from others. So that's just some of the characteristics in our state, as well as other rural communities. Often in rural West Virginia, suicide is perceived as a shameful, weak act. Not to mention a sin, and I unfortunately am going to share a story that I was not proud about, but we have hopefully progressed in awareness as time's gone on in implementation of our project. But one time I was actually doing a training, and I had a survivor present who was talking about losing her son to suicide, and someone in the crowd actually asked her if she believed her son was in hell, which was, obviously very difficult for her, and she responded in saying that she questioned this consequence at one point. However, her son completed suicide as a result of a mental illness. He was sick, and hence he died. And, I was just very proud of her for thinking of that and providing for some education. But there is, unfortunately, a really significant stigma associated with suicide in our culture, the third of which is that suicide should not be mentioned, so it does not occur. We know that that's a myth, those of us who are educated, but it tends to be difficulty in integrating into school systems sometimes or different communities that are scared to even approach the topic. I was in a school system that invited me, actually, to train the whole staff and educators on a gatekeeper, session in regards to what to recognize in their students. And when I arrived, the administrator said, we've had a few deaths. And I thought, oh, wow, we've got a long way to go here because we've got to say the word suicide before we can go any further in recognizing it. And it was interesting because the comment as I was going through the presentation and talked about this myth was that we're afraid if we say the word, we're going to cause for it to happen. And in no, by means, disrespectful manner, I just immediately thought about that and thought, have you said the word in your school system in the last 3 years? It was no, but yet you've had three deaths. So I think that kind of brought a point, and we've done that even in West Virginia. We were seventh in the nation in 2006, and since we've increased training awareness and started talking about suicide more openly, we're now ranked 22nd in the nation. So even though we know it's a myth, it's a common belief here among our population. Okay, with that said, there's several disadvantages and barriers to suicide prevention that are perhaps more prevalent in rural communities. Often in rural communities, seeking mental health treatment signifies weakness. And also in close-knit communities, everyone knows if you're getting mental health treatment. And so if you know, the mental health center is located at the top of the hill, then people know when you're traveling up to the top of the hill, you know, that's where you're going to go get, you know, some pills or get some help. And I know that this sounds kind of, and first of all, let me say that not all West Virginia is like this, but there still are these beliefs, and we have to meet the communities where they are in order to, you know, force suicide preventions ahead. So there is still stigma. There are also very, you know, mental health, pro-mental health associations as well. But, you know, again, I'm focusing on the rural. Even if mental health is desired, there's often a lack of access due to location of treatment facilities, a lack of available transportation. Rural communities don't have subways or buses, and not everyone has transportation to get to the mental health center. So there's a strong, and then finally, there's a strong sense of keeping family issues within the family, keeping your feelings and protected within your family. So such barriers really continue to warrant that need for a multifaceted approach. Finally, rural communities may be better prepared to launch prevention due to social and economic infrastructure. So there are strengths in rural communities that assist with suicide prevention efforts. Social infrastructures include churches, schools, community social clubs. Often the individuals in community are present in several of these institutions, and so as a result, there are pre-existing connections and collaborations. In rural cultures, there's also a strong sense of community with reciprocal loyalty and allegiance to each other. Even though suicide may be a rare occurrence in the community, when it's one of your own, there's a momentum and invested interest towards establishing efforts of prevention, contributing to an understanding that the whole community can play a part in suicide prevention. This has been demonstrated locally in a county in West Virginia, in which there have been several youth suicides over the course of the last year. And unfortunate as the deaths may be, the community has created a local coalition in efforts of suicide prevention. There's greater than 50 individuals, you know, on that coalition now that meet monthly across a wide array of disciplines. And, you know, it's really enhanced the consistency of recognizing and referring youth in that community. Might not advance. There we are. Historically, communities have relied significantly on clinical approaches, but again, as we previously mentioned, that's not always the most feasible or realistic means of individuals having some kind of instantaneous help. So the ultimate goal is to bring as many partners interacting with you to the table so that we can have a safety network for at-risk youth. Suicide prevention requires partnerships and simultaneous efforts on a multitude of fronts. And that prevention, intervention, media training, and educational activities across discipline is proved for us to be the most comprehensive means of implementing suicide prevention. Some of the work we've done in juvenile justice, we've worked with day reporting centers and providing technical assistance so that they can screen their youth as well as train their staff with the evidence-based QPR model. In schools, we have worked with active parental consent. We go into the schools and do a presentation, implement SOS, where the students are screened. And then if they're referred or they're screened high, we refer them and follow up with the adolescent suicide assessment protocol and determine whether or not they need continued follow-up. And then obviously link them to the most appropriate mental health facility. We also do a mobile quick response system, which I'm going to talk a little bit more extensively about in just a bit. And then finally, you know, again, we talked about the Church Alliance and Orientation in West Virginia. We do a lot of work in the faith-based communities. We've been invited to present to youth groups to present to youth pastors. We have some youth pastors just recently who have began to get their QPR certification so that they can do suicide or teach their whole congregation QPR. So I think that that's been a really good strength in our system. And again, there's the strength of West Virginia, and the thing that, you know, you got to be proud of is we do a lot of work across disciplines, and there is that connectivity that provides for a great infrastructure for these efforts. Suicide prevention is not only about education, but it's about promoting that connectiveness. Assuring that youth who are at risk are taught resiliency and connected to the community is a protective factor. So part of our work in promoting awareness, we not only disseminate information in various venues outside of the mental health field, but in order to establish community connections and serve individuals who may not have an opportunity to encounter such information, we try to go out into the community. It enhances collaborative efforts and allows for the decrease of stigma regarding suicide for both attempters and survivors. At these events, we have so many individuals approach us about their story, whether they be an attempt survivor or an actual survivor, someone who's lost their loved one to suicide, and we're able to help them create a network and support groups so that they have an outlet. And also, we just hope to help give them a voice. So some of the activities we've participated in include the Yellow Ribbon events for returning veterans and their families. We tend to just exhibit there and have done some brief presentations. We've also participated in reality tours held in secondary schools. Some West Virginia Department of Education wellness coordinators and local FRNs and RESAs have, you know, created these reality tours where the kids get to go to kind of different stations and learn about at-risk behaviors, et cetera, and we've been invited to participate in several of those. Some of them actually include a parents' night as well, which has been nice to have exposure to the dual audience. We've gone to street fairs, community city events, and then one unique thing that I was going to mention was we partnered with a local semi-professional baseball league in order to promote awareness. And in West Virginia, we don't have any professional sports team, so this is kind of as big as it gets in terms of semi-professional and having a baseball team. And the attendance tends to be sometimes 500 to sometimes a couple thousand people. And we always have a suicide prevention awareness night during the game. We have the Lifeline number on the back of ticket backs, and also our commercials run on their big scoreboard. And then, you know, we have the Aspen logo and Lifeline number on the field sign. So there's a multitude of ways to have exposure there. That was another way, too, of reaching the 15 to 24-year-old audience that maybe is not necessarily in that traditional school environment. So at least there's some exposure to, you know, a reference if they're at risk. And then we work with primary care. Our work here is not as extensive as I would like it to be, but we continue to work. The reason being is that whether they choose to or not, healthcare professionals are in the front line of defense and suicide prevention. You'll see from the slide that 20% of those who die by suicide visited their PCP within 24 hours. Primary care is the number one source for mental health treatment in the United States. And again, if there's a stigma associated with mental health treatment, there's not as much with medical health treatment. And so a lot of primary care medical visits are actually for psychosocial issues. So some of the things we've done is distribute the PCP toolkits that's on the sprc.org website to just various practitioners here in the community. We have a newsletter that's unique to West Virginia that we've distributed as well. The SAMHSA literature, After an Attempt for Self and After an Attempt for Families. There's also, I didn't mention them all because they're part of the toolkit, but there's the safety cards for physicians, and the feedback we've got from that has been very well in terms of it's useful to them. Working within pre-existing infrastructures is key to promoting suicide prevention and intervention efforts. Some of the work groups we work in enhance prevention awareness and recognition and referral are school-based health centers, which are widely distributed through the state. Obviously, they're great because it they're, you know, accessible to the students. We also have a pretty nice network of school-based mental health centers in West Virginia so that services can be provided in the school. We have West Virginia Department of Education wellness coordinators that are an absolute asset to our work and have really helped us connect to the schools and get in the schools and efforts. Adolescent health coordinators, and then we are part of multiple local coalitions like Family Resource Networks, Communities That Care, Substance Abuse Prevention Coalitions, and RESAs. So all that connectivity has been really valuable for our implementation. And finally, I just want to take a couple minutes, because I know we're getting close, in talking about our mobile quick response services. As a part of Cohort 2, which is our first grant award, West Virginia did mobile quick response services in Kanawha County. And the way that worked is we worked with every school counselor in the county, and they were trained in Gatekeeper as well as some of the administrators. And then if they identified a kid at risk, they would call our staff, and our staff would go out and assess them with the ASAP 20 and then refer them if they needed further mental health assistance. In regards to sustainability, the practice as it's designed has to be altered a bit, but because what we did was just enhance that recognition and referral so that once our staff wasn't facilitating it, the school was in the practice of contacting the crisis team here in Kanawha County. And we've expanded that actually to other counties. But during the course of that project, you'll see that in year one, we had 57 referrals, and then each year it grew and grew and grew as we, you know, got to really show the progress and the effectiveness of having that mobile quick response. This is just a slide talking about one of the things that we assessed for, obviously, was depression. And over the course of 3 months, you know, 81% of the kids who were followed up with treatment improved from severe to moderate, severe to mild, et cetera. And then finally, the power of community connections. Again, we were talking about in enhancing exposure. Just last year, here during the course of Cohort 5, Aspen screened greater than 1,000 kids with the SOS, and we referred, I believe it's 278 for follow-up treatment. So almost 30% of the kids we screened needed some kind of further follow-up treatment. And, you know, that's where the passion of our work lies, I think. Again, I mentioned we go in the schools, and, you know, when you follow that kid up and go to the ASAP and sit with them one-on-one and assess those items, you know, the things that they're walking around their school carrying are just really, you know, tough, and you have to just recognize it. And I know schools do the absolute best they can, and mental health does the absolute best they can, but it, again, takes that collaboration and all of these entities working together to make suicide prevention really work. Okay, with that said, and I'm right on time, I think, I do have a PSA that we worked on, and it may or may not work. We'll just find out.
All right, this should broadcast through your computer speakers, and if that's not working for you, I'm going to put the link in. Okay.
Great. Well, Barry, thank you very much. And I hope that folks were able to see that video. If not, you can click on the link that Bailey shared through the chat feature. At this point, we're going to open it up for questions, but instead of having audio questions, you can type your questions for Barry into the chat feature. Or if you have comments, now's your chance. Barry, while we're waiting for our first question, this is Erica. I have a question. I wanted to hear a little bit more about sort of if there are any non-traditional partners that you've been working with or others that you're thinking about working with in rural areas.
Besides the one we mentioned, well, we work with even Boys and Girls Clubs. We work with some of the Upward Bound, where students are selected from around the state to participate in a college-type experience. It's kind of a leadership academy during the summer. So we try to work with the kids who, you know, might not be reached in the school system. Overall, my experience in the work of suicide prevention, I think there is a difficulty in reaching those kids, and we all struggle with it. I think juvenile justice, actually Dr. McKeon was here today speaking about that, is really one place where we really need to focus a little bit more, because there's just a higher percentage of at-risk youth there. And we don't have to necessarily go into the detention centers, but the day reporting for the kids that go home every night, you know, I think that that's where our greatest strides have been.
Excellent. Thank you. I see there's somebody typing a question, so let's see that we have there. All right, while we're waiting for that question, I understand that foster care populations is an area where folks are... Oh, all right, I'll hold my foster care question. All right, Kathy Harkey said, you mentioned transportation and location of facilities being a concern in rural communities. Do you have crisis teams who go to the person in need?
Actually, part of that mobile quick response service, yes, those individuals will go to the school or the home, et cetera, but not in every county does that occur. We do have crisis lines in every county. There's a comprehensive mental health agency as a part of every county, but yet that still continues to be a problem, which is why, again, pastors and those kind of community individuals can still be resourceful in terms of intervening in order to get someone help. We also obviously promote the Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, and it's actually ran here in West Virginia. So, and all those individuals are trained and assist, and they work real closely with law enforcement. So that's kind of the way we do it in other counties. In regards to the foster care, we currently, and I didn't even think about this because we're in all kinds of different hats, but actually the statement of work for West Virginia next year, a requirement of training at least for foster care employees is going to be to have some kind of gatekeeper training. We hope to extend that to foster care parents. So it's just a consideration and obviously something in the work. And then finally, and Shelley's on the line, but I should mention that West Virginia just passed the Jason Flatt Act, requiring all school service personnel to have suicide prevention training every year. So we're really excited about that, too. So, again, we have recognition everywhere.
Thank you. All right, if there aren't any more questions, then I think we will thank you, Barry, and let you go back to your state meeting.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. If folks have other questions for Barry, you can type them. We can get them to her for later. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Nathan Bellew. He's the Senior Education Manager at the Trevor Project, overseeing the organization's education initiatives, including suicide prevention programs for youth and adults. Nathan assists local and state suicide prevention organizations across the country to educate and inform practitioners, educators, and administrators regarding best practices for working with LGBTQ youth. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak. Good morning, everyone. I've actually can see that a few of you I have worked with and am working with across the country. So some of this information will not be new to you, but perhaps there will be some new points as we go along in this discussion. So what I'm going to speak about is tools and strategies that we have found as an organization for incorporating and infusing information about LGBTQ youth into already existing systems and networks for suicide prevention. So I think this is a great kind of pairing of presentations, all the information that you just heard about, a variety of strategies specific, for instance, to rural communities, and all the different ways to pair with different community organizations, to reach youth, to advertise currently existing suicide prevention efforts. So when we think about those networks that we're all working to create and those efforts that we are expending to provide suicide prevention education to our communities and to do that work, sometimes we don't think about the variety of groups within our population. And obviously from the Trevor Project's perspective, the group that we especially think about is the LGBTQ population. So that's what I'll be talking about today. And as we progress, I'll be kind of framing that as to why does this population need our special attention, and then how can we reach out to affect change within that community. So first of all, this is who we are for folks who maybe aren't familiar with our work. The Trevor Project is the leading national organization that provides crisis intervention and suicide prevention services to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth. That's kind of our elevator speech. There's really a lot in that segment as to the work that we do. Just a couple things. We define youth rather broadly, so it's up to age 25. So just as we're talking about the services that we provide, keep in mind that it's a very broad youth definition. And also, all of our resources are available for anyone really within that age demographic, and even beyond. We have folks who access our services who are older than that age demographic sometimes, as well as folks who are not actually part of the LGBTQ community. We do have folks reach out to us who are just youth in general who need someone to talk to. So briefly, I'm going to talk about the resources and the programs that we provide, and then talk about our outward-facing education and how we are working already with folks who are doing suicide prevention work across the country. I know Scott Perkins is on the phone from Missouri. We're working along with them with their grant. In addition, we're working with the folks in New York State with the grant that they've received. And we also do work with smaller county-level grants in California. So I'll be talking about the things that we've learned through that experience. And then also, hopefully, you'll come away with some resources from us. In addition to the resources that you may already have, hopefully you'll learn about some new things that perhaps ways that we can work together. So why does an organization like the Trevor Project need to exist? I think it's important to kind of have that in the back of our mind as we move forward in this conversation. All of us know the first statistic, right? That suicide is the third leading cause of death for individuals 15 to 24, and the variations upon that statistic. When we talk about the LGBTQ community, LGB youth, and this study obviously is not inclusive of the transgender community, so lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth are four times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers. And we could have a conversation about why that is. That's a whole separate conversation, and one that I'd be pleased to have with any of you. Obviously, it's very complex as to the reason for that. But that's kind of our statistic about why this group needs special attention. They are four times more likely to attempt. When we think about the transgender population, within that population, 40% of them have actually reported that they have attempted. So the risk is even much higher for that group. So that's why we need to think about special resources and education regarding this population. So I want to just very briefly expose you to the work that we do, our programs. And this is information. You can go to our website to learn more. A very brief overview. Our primary resource is the Trevor Lifeline. It is the nation's only 24/7 suicide prevention and crisis intervention lifeline for LGBTQ youth. So it's a safe place for them to talk. It's much like any other suicide prevention lifeline that an individual would call, but it's specific to youth and especially has resources for that population. In addition, we have a host of resources online. So we have a program called Ask Trevor, where they can write in. It's kind of like a question and answer forum. And that's for non-urgent issues regarding sexual orientation and gender identity. In addition, we use Trevor Chat. So chat is something new and up and coming in the world of suicide prevention. Many youth today would rather chat through IM than talk on the phone. And so our organization has begun to use that. We also run a social networking site for LGBTQ youth. It's called Trevor Space, and that's growing at an exponential rate. I think the figure right now is around 25,000 members. And really, we think about that as a great prevention method. We know, obviously, that a sense of isolation is something that greatly increases the risk for suicide, and especially for this population, who very often feels isolated within their home, within their school community, other communities they might belong to. It's really important to decrease that sense of isolation, and a social networking site that is specific to them and safe for them can certainly meet that goal. So those are the programs that we provide that are directly for youth. In addition, we have a variety of educational programs, which is what I'm going to spend the rest of this presentation talking about. One is the Lifeguard Workshop Program, which is a suicide prevention and education program directly for youth. There are two variations upon that program. One is specifically for LGBTQ youth, so it's really kind of targeting that high-risk population. And the other is for youth in general, but it does also contain an anti-bias component regarding LGBTQ youth. In addition to that, our CARE trainings, which is our adult education program, which is a program where we really delve into why is this population at higher risk and what can we do about that, in addition to providing just general gatekeeper skills. So what are the warning signs of suicide? How should you respond to keep a youth safe? And then the Survival Kit is a resource that anyone can request from our website, where you can request resources from us as an organization. So that's a very quick overview of the resources that we have. So now really, to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about strategies, now that you have that background information. So if you're working from the perspective of doing suicide prevention within your region, within your state, and you know that this is a population that's at increased risk, of course, the question that comes to you is, how do I talk about that population? How do I infuse information about that population into the suicide prevention work that I'm doing? So the first step, I think, that would need to be taken in that situation is to really think about the folks that you're doing suicide prevention work with. What is their current knowledge regarding LGBTQ people? I think it's really important to do a needs assessment. That's going to vary greatly from place to place. So, for instance, if you're in a rural community in North Carolina, that would be very different than if you are in New York City, for instance. The general level of knowledge regarding the LGBTQ community might or might not be very different depending upon where you're located. So I think it's really important to take stock of how much knowledge do this audience have, how much knowledge do they have in general regarding this population. The next step would really be to think about the need to accurately describe and explain why these youth are at increased risk, keeping in mind the need for safe messaging. All of you received, before logging onto this webinar, a document regarding safe messaging for speaking about LGBTQ youth and suicide. And something that our organization and others who are trying to provide information on this topic really are trying to bring into the public dialogue is the need for talking about this population accurately and accurately describing why they're at increased risk for suicide. I think there's a lot of well-intentioned individuals who, you know, really want to help this population in particular, but might seek to oversimplify the issues in an effort to provide assistance. So one example of that would be saying that youth are being bullied to death, or bullying is leading to LGBTQ youth attempting suicide. In actuality, all of us know, of course, that the risk factors for suicide are many, and that it's actually a very complex issue. And obviously for this population, victimization is an additional concern. We do know that this population is victimized at a greater rate than their peers. So we do know that that's something that we need to target. However, it's not just because of bullying or just because of victimization. So when you do start to talk about this population, even if it's just as a side note when you're doing QPR or other trainings, to think about making sure that you're wording things appropriately and carefully. Another thing to think about as a strategy for all of us is the fact that we're doing suicide prevention education, right? So there's a lot of programs out there. There's QPR, there's ASSIST. So to think about how to make sure that these trainings that we're conducting are competent when it comes to the area of LGBTQ youth. So providing some sort of resource and information to the gatekeepers that you're training regarding LGBTQ youth so that it's not just an invisible population, but helping to bring into view that this population is at increased risk, that we do need to have a conversation about them. I think what's interesting when we think about this population, much as we observed and in the previous conversation we just had, we talked about how talking about suicide can be very taboo. It's, you know, an uncomfortable word to bring into an environment. And it's really interesting. I think there's a parallel regarding LGBTQ issues. Oftentimes, it's a taboo subject to talk about this population and this group of youth. So since we're kind of in the habit as a group and a community to talking about some of these uncomfortable topics for some, I think we can think about the fact that we also need to be infusing information about this population into the education that we're doing. And I think, you know, the last part of that statement there is to stress that when we're doing gatekeeper trainings or education around this topic, I think there's a fear of some individuals, just as many fear when they're becoming a gatekeeper, that they have to be an expert about mental health. Also, some folks might fear that they have to be an expert around LGBTQ issues to help an LGBTQ youth. So I think it's really important to stress, as we're infusing this information into the education that we're doing, that folks don't have to become an expert, but it is important to learn to be competent to help this special population. So here are two kind of suggestions or models, potential models for thinking about, you know, if you're doing suicide prevention work, how will you infuse this into the work that you're already doing? How can you start talking about LGBTQ youth? So here are two models that we suggest. One would be if you've done that kind of survey of your population and you recognize that your group might need some very basic LGBTQ education, it might be beneficial to conduct an LGBTQ-specific training prior to your gatekeeper education training. The benefits of that is that they are allowed to have a more in-depth conversation about LGBTQ-specific issues and resources. The challenges to that, obviously, would be time and participation. You might not be able to have everyone who's going to participate in your ASSIST training or QPR training, for instance, to come to this special session just on LGBTQ issues, obviously because of time considerations. So if you can't do that, the second model, which I think really all of us should be doing as a model of kind of seeking to be competent, is to insert LGBTQ information into your already existing gatekeeper training. So I think, you know, I've learned from doing this work that a lot of people are already doing that informally. They're already starting to kind of say, okay, let's have a separate conversation about this group. Obviously, the benefit of that is that you're reaching all your participants who are going through QPR education, and there's less time commitment. And then the challenges to that, obviously, is the time limitation. You can't provide a really in-depth view of the issues facing this population in a 20-minute kind of sidebar conversation about this population. So obviously, there's kind of the necessity for looking at both of these models. I think, though, that really we should start looking at the second model as kind of being baseline for best practice. We know that this population is at higher risk. In many ways, it's the responsible thing to do, to start thinking about ways to talk about them when we're doing gatekeeper training. It struck me in the last conversation, we just learned that West Virginia just passed this law mandating that all of their school professionals have gatekeeper training. If in addition, all of those professionals also received LGBT education as part of that gatekeeper training, you know, my mind was thinking how much we could actually decrease the risk for that population, for instance, in the state of West Virginia. So I'd like to expose you briefly to our education program and our gatekeeper training. And as a potential model for if you're thinking about doing LGBTQ specific kind of gatekeeper education. So we obviously, we talk about the Trevor Project. We do an overview of LGBTQ terminology, kind of what do all those acronyms mean? Because that's the first thing to a lot of comes to a lot of people's minds. It's very confusing. And then we do look at the research regarding this specific population and the, their attempts. And then, of course, like any training, the general risk factors and warning signs for suicide, how to respond to those, and also the LGBTQ-specific risk factors and warning signs. And then we also give kind of tips for environmental concerns. How do we create better environments overall to decrease the risk for this population? Just as kind of a side note, this presentation specifically is now available once a month via webinar, actually via our organization. And in fact, there's one occurring this afternoon. So if that's something you're interested in, just kind of looking at our model of having this conversation, feel free to go to our website and register for that webinar. It'll be happening on the third Wednesday of every month. So in addition to that education, which we're doing in an intense way, and we're partnering to do that education in the places that I listed at the beginning, there are resources that we have for folks who are doing gatekeeper education. One of those being the safe messaging document, which you should have received, the care workshop webinars, which I just told you about, and a new resource, which we are actually in the process of creating, which will be very exciting, is if you're doing suicide prevention education and you want to infuse this information into your trainings but maybe don't know how to talk about it, we are creating a few slides that could be added as a supplement to the education that you're already seeking to do. It will be a brief overview of the resources we provide. I think it's really important for folks to learn about our programs and the fact that there is a line that youth in their own communities can call that's specific to this population to kind of break down that barrier and that invisibility. And also to just very briefly expose them to the fact that this is a population that is at higher risk. So those are currently being created. That's something to look for. Please feel free to contact me if you're specifically interested in that. In addition, something that actually is not on this slide, if you're thinking about those two models of doing kind of infusing LGBTQ issues into gatekeeper education, and then also thinking about maybe having a longer conversation first, we have developed a program which has an in-depth conversation about LGBTQ issues. It's referred to as the Trevor Ally Program. And so if you're interested in that presentation and how you could perhaps use that presentation to do kind of a baseline LGBTQ education in your community prior to a gatekeeper training, that's also something that we could provide. So that's really all the information that I have. And just as kind of a brief recap, I think that, you know, it's really positive we're in this place of thinking about how can we take strategies we already know are working, infrastructure we already have that's existing, that's doing this education, and now really expand this to talk about populations that we know that need additional resources. So I look forward to partnering with each of you as we work together to have that conversation in our communities.
Thank you, Nathan. That's great. We now have time to have a few questions for Nathan. And again, if you just want to type those into the chat feature, I can read them. I'll get started. I imagine you've been getting a lot of attention. I know this topic is just, you know, sort of becoming just more and more in the media. Where do you see the Trevor Project going? Where do you see this field going?
That's a great question. We have grown exponentially over the last year, which a lot of folks have probably observed. I would kind of highlight two areas that we're growing in, one being in our crisis services. So we're constantly developing and adapting new strategies for providing programs for youth, a lot of those in the digital space. So, for instance, Trevor Chat right now is only one day a week. and that's being expanded. Really all of our kind of digital initiatives for reaching youth, especially with kind of that cognition that that is how youth are communicating nowadays. So thinking about how to do suicide prevention effectively and safely using digital means, that's one area I think our organization is really being a pioneer in. And the other is, I think, in what we are talking about today in education and bringing that conversation and infusing those competencies into gatekeeper education. I know the SPRC has a fantastic guide already for folks who are interested, and I know that everyone received that in the email that went out for kind of having that LGBTQ-specific suicide prevention conversation. And I think that there's obviously a lot of opportunity for us as an organization to kind of provide the special way that we talk about that to folks who are doing gatekeeper education. And also, I think within the LGBT community, so people who are doing LGBT education in communities, we have LGBT community centers across the country that are doing just general LGBT awareness training. And many of them are being looked on by their local communities also to be experts around LGBT mental health. So I think we kind of have several places that we need to bring people up to speed, helping folks to learn about mental health within our own community, and how to talk about it effectively and accurately, and also how to talk about LGBT issues when you're talking about mental health.
Great. We have time for one or two more questions. I thought we had a question coming. Here we go. From Jennifer Allison, could you say more about the factors that contribute to higher rates of suicide attempts among LGBTQ youth?
Absolutely. That is a pretty lengthy conversation, and I would encourage you also to reach out to me via email. There's my email address if you'd like to continue that conversation. It really is complex. There are a variety of factors. We know that LGBTQ youth are more likely to be victimized within school. 75% of this population says that they experience victimization. 15% say that it's physical victimization in school. And one-third say that when they come out, they lose friends. So all of those things we know from the research are predictors of kind of negative mental health outcomes. Being victimized physically and verbally, losing friends, all of those things. In addition to that, LGBTQ youth have the issues of their families. So many LGBTQ youth also have issues within their family around their sexual orientation and gender identity. And the youth who experience that, from the research we know, are 8 times as likely as their LGBT peers to attempt suicide. So that's an additional factor. One other I would highlight, we know that homelessness is an additional factor for any individual for attempting suicide. It's a risk factor. And statistically, this population is at much higher risk for homelessness. Our current data suggests that it's somewhere between 20 to 40% of the youth homeless population in the United States is actually LGBTQ. From my conversations with folks who run youth homeless shelters, both in rural America and in the cities, I think that that statistic might actually be low. Some folks report that when they do a survey, they find that 60% of the youth in their shelters are LGBT identified. So homelessness is definitely another risk factor that is looming within this community. But there are a variety of other factors that we could talk about as well. That's a great question. Thank you.
I think we have a question from Scott Perkins. Let's see. Here we go. Nathan has been very helpful to us in Missouri, and I would encourage everyone to connect with the Trevor Project. Thank you.
Thanks for the shout-out, Scott.
Oh, and we have from Julie Evans. For more information about reasons for and data about LGBTQ youth suicide attempts, you can view the SPRC archived webinar, and you can see that link here. I don't know if that was one that that was attached to your resources on Monday, so please check that out. Great. All right, well, I'm going to take over and just do a little bit of wrap-up. Again, Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, this is a discussion that we had. So I just wanted to give folks the heads up about our upcoming meetings and what's next for this community practice. And, of course, I'll follow up with everyone via email as well. But these are our upcoming meetings, April 25th, May 16th, and June 20th. And we'll be continuing with some of the topics that you all selected before the community practice started. We're also going to start getting you ready to work in your state teams. I know that some members of teams have met already, but I think that most have not yet. So during the next month, you'll be hearing from me about bringing your teams together, starting to think about your state data and your priorities and what kind of project you'd like to take on. So look for information about that, and we may be able to use some fancy interactive technology to do some of those meetings virtually. So please save these dates for upcoming meetings. We'll keep you posted about that. And then if there's nothing else, I just wanted to wrap us up. Hold on a second. Bailey sent me a note. Okay. So, again, thank you all for coming. I hope you gained some useful information. If you have questions, you can type those into the chat box, either for us or for the presenters, and we can pass those along. And we have a quick questionnaire that's going to pop up at the end of this event. If you could please take a moment, we really appreciate your feedback. And Bailey will be sending out a link to the archive recording of this webinar within within the week or so. And again, let's see, is the survey about to pop up? Yes, it's on the chat feature. You can click on that. And that's it, everybody. Thanks very much, and have a great day.